Bob, you told me off mic, or rather on mic but off air, that you want to present something. So, Bob, will you go ahead and present it?
Yes, I listened to Zappa as Hoover, which you did in October 2004. It's on your Out to Lunch, Late Lunch archive, and found it very interesting, both parts. And here's what was sparked. In January 92, I was in Costa Rica with Jerry Fialca. He went on a trip with Carolyn and I. And we would sit at night in the jungle, and the rain would come down, and we would talk, and he'd tape it. Well, I did in that period something that we transcribed, and we decided to title it "Entertainment Sucks." Now that was done 12 years before your show. And what I meant by "Entertainment Sucks," you work on in Zappa as Hoover. So I found it quite synchronistic and delightful how you approach Zappa as a Hoover vacuum cleaner, because that is for me, and I did not know this till I heard your show last week in the archive, that is the crux of what I think I'm talking about, and what the phrase "entertainment sucks," the multi-leveled ways you look at the sucking in, the inevitable pleasure, all this resonance and multi-level meanings of the word suck, and what the media environment is, the entertainment world, and how you relate to it. You wrestle with that, and you come up with that as a key to Zappa, and I agree with it. And it also is a key to Finnegan's Wake, a key to McLuhan, a key to the Menippean tradition. I guess the way to concretize it is to point out that the vacuum is something that the viewer, the consumer, hallucinates in or fills in the space. Do you remember that aspect of the vacuum that you were saying?
Yeah, I mean, most conventional entertainment seems to put something out, doesn't it? It seems to give you something concrete. It seems to be somebody fermenting their ejaculata in your face. The feeling that they're expressing themselves leaves gobs on your own face. And I appreciated Frank Zappa as soon as I heard him, because something else was going on. And this is really this is why we call these dialogues over the oeuvre of Frank Zappa, because we both agree about that. But it's rather larger than simply being a Frank Zappa fan. I mean, we are embattled and militant Frank Zappa fans when we meet people who don't see the point and diss him. But this perception, this idea of behaving culturally in a way that is not, that enables the audience to be creative themselves is key. And it's also because we think Frank actually did it, whereas there's a lot of hot air about that within art schools, for example. I mean, a lot of followers of John Cage, a lot of postmodernists will say that what they are trying to do is precisely that, don't they? I mean, have you heard these? You see, the thing is, I completely agree with you, and I think Frank does do something special. He inverts the relationship, and he says things on his records like, "We're listening," and you feel very puzzled when you first hear that from other people, because you're going, "But I'm listening to him. How can he be listening to us?" And then you gradually realise that what the reason that Frank Zappa puts out records is he's interested in what will happen to the people who are listening to him. So he's observing you, and he's inverted that relationship.
Now, he's studying the effects.
Yeah, because that is the interesting thing of being involved in mass media. The idea of simply broadcasting yourself is actually boring, because you already know what you are, and to broadcast it more and more, you know, where does that go? And the thing is that I think Frank actually did it. Why I often come back to Frank in debates about what we should do with this society we're in, because it seems to me there is a big phony version of this idea going on, which is the idea that somehow if art does not communicate, if it's obscure and self-destructive and empty, it's somehow a plus, because then the user can make up their own meaning. And you have this on the walls of all sorts of art galleries, little panels of people explaining that this artist just leaves the viewer there to make up their own idea. And if you tried to apply that to Frank, you'd immediately know it was wrong, because Frank is not interested in simply you making up your own fantasy and projecting it in an empty space, is he? He might be giving you a vacuum, but the vacuum sucks. It pulls on you. It alters you. It has a material effect on you. It's not simply a vacancy.
Exactly. So I wanted to... The idea of projecting your own fantasy is what he's actually critiquing, even though his work provides the scenario for you to do that, but he is confronting you while you do it. See, it's a dialectic, it's tactile. That's what you're saying, it seems to me. That he's critiquing the open space, the blank space we have, and that's why he seems to be aggressive, or all the weak people who can't take the intensity of Frank. It's because they want to just project their own fantasy.
And they favour... I mean, I've always summarised visually what Frank Zappa is against when I compare his album covers to those of Yes. And do you remember the artwork that Roger Dean used to deliver for Yes to put on their covers? It amazed me...
It's so anemic, I never even saw them. I never listened to Yes, so I don't remember the covers.
Well,
I don't know them.
Yeah, the covers really struck me because... up till then, underground rock covers had been kind of surprising, and you never quite knew what you were getting, and they were very lavish or detailed, psychedelic, but it always seemed to be quite peculiar, and you'd pick them up and the immediate explanation would always be these people are on drugs. But they didn't seem to have continuity between one record and another. They seemed to be what the band came up with. And suddenly, with Yes, I felt there's been a calculation. We need a band identity, a corporate identity. And it's somebody who's copied Japanese art and is able to do airbrushed seas and skies that recede. And it's fantasy landscapes in a kind of soft way that includes... extremely conventional Art Nouveau derived beauty of nude women and waterfalls and all this kind of very obviously pleasing stuff. And I was very surprised that a rock band should adopt this cover artist, who then on every one of their record covers would kind of wallpaper them with this special decor. And it's always amazed me that so few people point out how kitsch these covers actually are, or what an abuse of the rock aesthetic it really was. But very few people did. And it seems that Frank's covers always had this jarring effect, which initiated an idea of beauty as incongruity, that its very incongruity on the shelf next to the other records had a humorous element and something which made you notice specific things.
Ben, it's interesting. It sounds a bit like he is throwing a gob in your face, but I know that's not what he's limited to, and he also is creating an open space. So it's totally a dialectic between giving you an open space, but not for you to just throw your projection in there. He also is challenging you with the open space. And you follow that?
Yeah, and inviting you to seek to explain what he's doing and to connect humorously or otherwise the motifs that he's presenting and introducing a surrealist effect in your everyday life as these motifs tumble out.
And that's why he responded to your book.
Well, maybe it was. I mean, it may have been the absolute incongruity of a Cambridge educated intellectual writing about his music that tickled him.
That was it, I think. It was the surrealistic response to his own surrealism.
Yeah, and I mean, in you feel so thrown back by the powers of interpretation that exist in the mass media. It's not something that worries you, Bob. You tend to be able to allow it to kind of wash off you and pursue your own interests, ignoring what it does. But as quite often on these shows, I become the patient and you're the therapist. I find I get disappointed and dented by the success of the ridiculous, stupid explanation of things, so that in some senses you sometimes just give up and allow the wrong explanation to rule, because it just seems everywhere. I mean, the explanation of Frank as genius composer, great guitar player, someone who, you know, these sort of words of praise always make me wince, because they're leading away from describing any particular thing he actually did to you and does to people, and seems to ignore the fact that every time you put one of his records on, you create a row among people. You know, that, and okay, this is always quietly forgotten, you know, in these praise to Frank the genius that you get in the pro-Zappa people. And I can never understand why they don't know that they are becoming sickening when they're talking like this.
And Frank even satirizes them, I think, in World for the Money. He says, you think you know, and he anticipates that kind of fan. That he makes fun of that kind of fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of him, that kind of fan of him. But okay, Ben, I didn't finish my intro, so here's I do Entertainment Sucks 12 years before you spell it out, and you don't spell it out to yourself about the Hoover until you're forced to think about it by that request from the Montreal Magazine circuit. You then put together this disparate pattern you probably had lurking in you, but it never got clarified till you had to write about it, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it was a response to the way that Frank himself pronounced the word oeuvre. Frank had a, you know, in the same way that he felt, I find it interesting, I'll have to ask questions of you as a North American, what the associations of France are. But within the English system, because of the invasion of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom by William the Conqueror in 1066, French has always been associated with the upper classes. And so if you referred to your work as your oeuvre, using the French term, it would always in English have a slight sense of you are looking at things from slightly higher up the social scale. So my feeling was that when Frank used the word oeuvre about his own work,
rather than project object,
which he made up himself, or the term work, there was an irony in it and a reference to the French way of looking at things, and he wasn't going to adopt a French accent and pronounce it properly. He was going to adopt the word and turn it into something else. And when I heard it, I heard him say, my Hoover. You know, he wasn't going to make his tongue go around those difficult French vowels. He was going to find the nearest word he could find in the way he pronounced and say it. And that immediately had resonance to me because of the way that the industrial vacuum cleaner was a theme in Frank Zappa's music. There's a famous painting of an industrial vacuum cleaner as a mutant gypsy going around a campfire in Chunga's Revenge, and also Captain Beefheart is holding a vacuum cleaner on the cover of on the inner fold of Hot Rats. And
so, Ben, are you thinking of those images in October 93 when he says that to you? Do you immediately think of that part?
Absolutely, yeah, because I'd always loved those references to vacuum cleaners, because it was so, I mean, the term at the time for the use of such things was bizarre. Because within the terms of the Elvis Presley style rock and roll commercialism, a vacuum cleaner is the last thing that you would have near a rock performer, because it's domestic, it's boring, it collects dust, it's not glamorous, it's not about cars and women, and, you know, of course it is all about cars and women and all the rest of it, but in a different way. And intuitively, I liked vacuum cleaners in Zappa and Beefheart. It reminded me of Dada. It reminded me of what I liked about Dada, because it was, it seemed to make fun of the serious people around me who were consuming culture. It seemed to just posit something ridiculous, which made you think. It's later on that I kind of unpacked the much grander philosophical idea of a dialectical art object that you're talking about, or indeed the sexual politics of emphasizing domestic labor and all the rest, which runs as a very powerful theme throughout Frank's work.
Yeah, now, before I forget, the one thing I might add to your inventory of the sucking action implied by the symbol of the vacuum cleaner, I don't have this, but I remember reading, I think it was in my mind, Downbeat magazine. There's an interview with Zappa in 71, 72, and I've never been able to find it, I don't think, again. But he recommends, and I want to know if you know this, he recommends for solving the ills of America, he recommends suck power. Does that trigger any bells there? Do you know what suck power is?
Well, I remember. Isn't that asking hippie chicks to give blowjobs to men in the establishment, powerful men, and thereby using their sexual powers to influence the behavior of powerful men? Yeah,
that's exactly it.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
How do you know that? Did you have the article?
No, I remember this argument. I don't remember him calling it that, but I do remember this somewhat naive idea of sexual freedom could be used.
It's Reichian idea, right?
Yeah,
he thought that the ills of the corruption in Washington would be cured if they got a few good blowjobs.
Oh, I see. Yeah, he's thinking of it. I was thinking about another argument, which is to do with what revolutionary, radical women should do, freak women should do, and they should use their sexual powers to influence the men in suits. And I always thought, but the problem is that they wouldn't actually want to go to bed with the men in suits. They wouldn't like them.
They wouldn't be committed enough to do that.
Yeah, that.
Are you saying that hippie idea, what you just said, is that not Zappa? That's not Zappa? That's another
idea? I think Frank entertained both ideas in various interviews.
Okay, so yes, I'd like to find out where I read that, because I don't think, I have a pretty good archive, but I don't think I have that, and I can never find it again. But you do remember him saying, advocating sock power?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so that totally reinforces this whole point about the meaning of the vacuum cleaner and all that. I think that's a major point about the importance of the symbolism of the vacuum cleaner and the sucking action.
And the other thing that I used to wonder about, and I've been wondering about for decades, but never really had the courage to ask anybody about, is the vacuum cleaner known among kids who joke, boys who joke about masturbation? Is it known as a device for you know, that if you took the brush off the end and used the tube and put it around your risen member, you know, could it induce an orgasm?
I did not grow up in North America, so I never heard that as a young person since I was in France. But
yeah,
I did hear stories later, when maybe younger people or somebody was telling me that there were tragedies. Somebody's penis got trapped in the thing. You know, I got negative associations with people attempting it. I don't know where I got that from, but that's all I got on that.
But you have heard of that
people
orifice
doing it,
being some kind of usable sexual device in the absence of a vibrator or indeed a woman.
And I recall hearing it in North America. You know, in my mind, it was a North American television.
Yeah, so I think that's the reason why the vacuum cleaner becomes a thing in early Zappa and Beefheart. It's the residue of that. There's also the famous story told by Jimmy Carl Black that Captain Beefheart did sell vacuum cleaners door to door, and one of his lines was, "This really sucks." I think because he understood that the people answering the door wouldn't know the underground or obscene meaning of sucks, so that he was able to say, "This is a rubbish vacuum cleaner," without them knowing what he was saying. I think,
that's true. I think it's interesting that I'm onto the sucking theme 12 years before, and here is what I said about Zappa in this interview, which you can get on my 5body.com website. I think it's interesting that I say this 2 years before your book comes out, and I want to see what you think of it. Jerry asked me, "So, another term that's immediately brought up in your book," meaning my book, Fatic Communion with Bob Dobbs, that I'm fond of is freedom. So Jerry takes the word freedom, which I always translate to be liberation. So then Jerry, who was working for Zappa at the time, so the artist, take Frank Zappa for example, appears to his audience to be totally liberated because he can express exactly what he wants. And Jerry continues, and I think maybe he's touched on small A art at times. Now, I'm making a distinction between capital A art, commercial art, and small A art, which is like James McDougall or just what you like, the guy playing the sax in the, above the Royal Albert Hall, you know, in that Zappa Hoover thing. Just or what do you call your things, the Easton Plastic events? I would call that small A art. And I'm talking early in the interview between how I'm a great small A artist, I'm not a capital A artist. So Jerry says, I think maybe Zappa's touched on small A art at times. Maybe you could talk about that. And what indeed is freedom? How does Bob define freedom? Or how does Bob define liberation? So here's how I answer. I would say liberation, freedom, is understanding and awareness of the effects of the environment you're in and the effects they create on you and those around you, as well as the causes and nature of that particular environment. So, Zappa uses rhythmic freedom and polyrhythmic extravagance because he knows, he intuits on the level of Duchamp that music is obsolete or that the ear is obsolete. Therefore, you can muck around with as many disciplines of music as possible. But I said in my videotape with you, Jerry, I'm saying to Jerry, last September, that that's manipulating satire within the specialist tradition. You're still working within a music zone. For those who lack the understanding of the electric environment as the ultimate music in itself, they will favor music as a medium of expression because it is released from the historical baggage of visual space, which is the average electro peasant today is learning to be free of visual space. That's what I really think the counterculture was. But we've had that freedom in the acoustic arts for almost 100 years now. Zappa is the final extreme statement of freedom in using sound. Read that again. Zappa is the final extreme statement of freedom in using sound. But again, he's just working in that one sensory apparatus. He doesn't talk about the ground of the electric environment, ground in quotes, the most musical corporate poem that would outdo anything that Frank ever aspired to. But since the audience is always well behind true understanding of the times, Frank appears as a rearview mirror nostalgic image, as someone who is the most avant-garde in the sound world because he intuits the extravagance and the freedom to use sound in any way as well as to use sound in a very disciplined way. With both the traditional currents in art, freedom and or discipline, spontaneity or controlled order, Frank walks the interval between the two via music. And that's an appropriate strategy if you're going to try to appear the most avant-garde in music. But again, Zappa is communicating in a mass electric environment where his content, his point of view, his style will be subsumed by many other musicians who are content in daily consumption of a radio or TV environment or a record or CD or tape environment. So Zappa's efforts are puny, very tiny gestures, and ultimately futile. But you can see that people of a certain level of education and sophistication would pass through the Zappa school as they learn to appreciate the fact that the environment musically is a lot more radical than Frank could ever express. But you can see why Zappa could approach true freedom because he knows how to use the electric spontaneity where the audience gets in the act. He knows how to play off the musical profiles of the period, the musical contours, the fads, the corporate images. And he also incorporates discipline, which the traditional educated Westerner, or even the average Westerner, has interiorized as the discipline of visual space and feels that's an important part of musical nature, nature in quotes. So Frank has staying power in that world because he has the discipline element covered. He's not like Bob Dylan or any of these guys who have a certain level of control and discipline, but Dylan and them are subsumed into a Dionysian abandon, which is the ultimate message they're trying to get across. You know, for heavy metal guys, it's total release. Now, they again are just miming the total release of the electric environment, which puts everybody into a discarnate state as free as the wind. When you're on the air, you are discarnate. When you're free as the air, you have no physical dimensions. You are on junk, and I mean by that heroin. You are stone. Now, that means that the ultimate anti-environment to that would be the human body. Then I go into this Christian thing, and do I come back, then I say, and all technologies are linguistic. This is where you spot off words on your radio show, and you want us to enjoy the massage of the words, not just the meanings, the semantic meanings. So look at all our technologies as like that. So the word has been mutating via technological forms through history, and that's the 10 thunders of Finnegan's Wake, by the way, until finally it's been reconstituted in the electric universe as Humpty Dumpty, the egg brought back together again, and not by the king's men or the king's horses, because they were bureaucrats who could never do it by visual industrial means. It could only be done by that particular collective extension of man, the electric environment. That brought the verbal universe back together again and made the universe resonate with the word, the power of the word. And therefore, it is essentially Christ's second coming created by all of us in our history through building these consecutive technological environments, climaxing with the reconstitution of the spoken word, fully conscious of itself in all directions and positions, upside down, forwards, backwards, like a cubist painting. That means that the contemporary to... That means that the complementary to this reintegration is that we have burst into the silent sea. I'm quoting Coleridge's poem, The Ancient Mariner. And the silent sea is the awareness that language is a tool that has many effects and leads to many extensions of itself, and therefore we don't need to replay that process once we understand it. So we can talk like Adam and Eve and begin a process and ignore its consequences. Actually, it won't have the consequences because we would be aware collectively of the effect of any word, which includes all media. As McLuhan said about William Burroughs, when Burroughs had said that McLuhan was a word analyst, McLuhan said, well, Burroughs was correct if you consider all media, airplanes, bulldozers, skyscrapers, as the content of the word. And the word is the power of speech, which is what distinguishes man from the beast. And it's not necessarily the fact. I mean, people could say birds speak to each other, or animals speak to each other, but the difference is that man teaches via speech and can learn via speech. Jerry says, okay, and then the animals don't. And then I say, and that means matching. And then Jerry says, but there's matching involved when the bird teaches how to eat. I go, yeah. Then Jerry says, but they're using matching but not words. I say they can match with their program spectrum. They cannot imagine new scenarios. Jerry says, which could mean sounds. I go, yeah, they match within sounds and it's a program spectrum. Jerry says, I'm saying the bird matches, says, whistles like a bird, Jerry whistles, and that means for the little bird to open up to eat a worm. I go, right. Then Jerry says, so that's just like a mother saying open. I go, right. Then Jerry says, so then there is a similarity in communication, even though the man is using words and the animal is using sounds. I say, that's right, but the difference between man and animals, this is what Lynn LaRouche pointed out, is that the spectrum of possibilities and matching is different between man and the animals. The animals don't have a choice. They have a limited range of options. Jerry says, okay, they don't, okay, and I go, we had the choice. And choice is not just a moral issue or a frivolous one. We had the choice to build our own whole universe, to build a whole new nature, which is what all technology is. And so we expanded our spectrum with technology. And the task for us is to realize the responsibility of that, which is Bob's Media Ecology. So a bird remains forever a bird in the nest, but man has gone from Atlantis, or maybe from a cave, to the situation right now where he or she has access to the whole universe. A bird couldn't do that. And then Jerry says, and the man could say open in a belligerent sort of authoritarian voice, or in a sweet motherly voice, whereas the bird can only just say open in one voice. I say, well, the bird might have some emotional tone. And then Jerry goes, do you think so? And I go, yeah, I think that people think that animals cuddle each other or have different emotional tones than they do. But the point is that when you say man can be dictatorial or comforting, it depends on the medium he uses. If he uses print or the alphabet or papyrus, he can extend his dictatorial control over vast spaces. But he needs the media of papyrus and the alphabet to do that. If he doesn't have papyrus, but he has clay tablets, then he can extend his power over time as opposed to space. Then you get long-lasting oral dynasties with priesthoods. Those are the different types of dictatorial control. The dictatorial control by the animal is in a much smaller range.
Well, Master Bob, I'm very pleased with your essay for this seminar, and I'm pleased we've now got on to surplus value, because I was a little worried that we were talking about universal man. But now we're on to surplus value, I feel we're grounded in actual history. Please carry on.
And so I go, you know what I mean, Jerry? And he goes, yes. And I go, a tiny range. Jerry says, right. Well, can we go back a step, back to the words freedom and liberation? And I go, which are technologies? Think of those things not as abstract images, but as technologies, which evoke certain mental images. And then Jerry says, okay, because I want to talk about the artist in terms of outsider art or children's art, and maybe bring in somebody like Beefheart, who's almost like a kindergartner at times, although he has witty wordplay. But take, Jerry continues, but take some child who will create a little phrase and make up a little song on their own spontaneously, or the mental patient who will draw the most amazing painting because he's totally liberated from any ideas of saying, quote, I'm going to create a piece of art now. He doesn't think that, he just does it. It's just flowing out of him like the child, says Jerry. It just flows out of them naturally. You know what I'm saying? I go, yeah. Well, you're romanticizing the traditional arts, Jerry. Remember, painting and singing and making up tunes or making drawings or any ancient arts are very puny and microorganismic compared to the arts of movie environments or TV environments or satellite environments or even the printing press or newspaper environments. Jerry says, well, are you the only one creating small A art? I go, yes, because to make small A art, you have to understand the whole technological history of capital A art and not identify with it. And you know the figure ground effects or the causes and effects of that process. And then you break through the vanishing point into media ecology or an understanding of the effects, which if you have a grasp of it, you could communicate in small A art terms. So to make a song, I mean, songs are just speech slowed down, or the rhythms of the culture expressed in speech altered slightly. That's why the Chinese have a whole different musical sensibility than we, because their language is so different from ours. And therefore, their ears hear and are involved in their particular language in such different frequencies or pitches that when they alter and play with that language when making music, it's very foreign to other cultures' ears. Now, that's the way it was up until now. Now that we're discarnate and can flow and put on and wear all these different cultures because speech is obsolete, and if music is related to speech, then Chinese music is easily absorbed because the new music is a result of the new speech being the new technological environment. So that, for example, the new music of the radio language or the radio environment was jazz. There was a music that responded to the electric syncopated interval rhythms of the radio environment. So, of course, a new music comes out of a new technological environment, just as when TV came in, which had many different qualities and textures from radio. The TV environment is a different kind of extension of speech. It's a new language that humans are wearing and communicating with. It also created a different kind of slowed-down speech or music, which was rock and roll. A whole new invented sensibility came out of a whole new technological situation. So when I say music is the rhythm of the language slowed down, then rock and roll is the rhythm of the TV language slowed down or mutated. What's interesting about rock and roll is that its basic rhythms are all mechanical beats and rhythms of the urban mechanical period of the last 100 years. So once we moved into the discarnate silent sea, we could put on the screeching sounds of factories and railroads and the whole 19th century industrial environment as musical entertainment via the tactile electric instrument. So you can see Beefheart was just meeting a certain fad, the young people's sensibility, the baby boomer generation in the later 60s, when they were trying to get back on the natural human scale ground by taking their shoes off and touching and walking in the earth and trying to retrieve the anti-discarnate state. Beefheart comes up as an image of a wild man out in nature, and he meets a need, an image response of that period, but it's soon overturned. Remember Warhol, everybody becomes famous for 15
minutes.
Yeah,
but Bob, recall that when Captain Beefheart is photographed in nature, he holds up a broken...
Lamp.
Yeah, with a light bulb in it, which immediately refers to electricity and the urban environment. So he's not posing in the countryside as a back-to-nature person. He's there as... It has a rebarbative, it makes you think about the relationship between the two.
Exactly, but I'm talking about the general impression that he's a wild man out in nature, you know. That's,
well, Jerry's argument
art,
there.
His art is not that.
No, his art is extremely conscious of what's been done in art beforehand. I mean, he doesn't put brush on canvas and reproduce any art that's been there before. That he's a very proud modern artist, who, and the pride of modern art is not to repeat. And he definitely does not repeat.
And what was striking what's striking about his poetry is that he would put in these weird, obscure technological gadgets, you know, into the poetry. So definitely, yes, he was not stuck in nature in his poetry. But it's interesting, he becomes popular because people think that's what he is, because they're out running around in the communes in nature in the late 60s. And then Do you really think so?
I thought all those people didn't like Captain Beefheart. I thought Captain Beefheart became popular simply because he had a voice which was unanswerably great, and he was such a powerful performer that he was always going to attract attention. And whatever he did, he was going to attract attention. And what he did was he went so far out that he had to be marketed as a freak. But someone of Captain Beefheart's abilities is always going to have people paying attention to him.
That is those that heard him. But you look at any articles on Beefheart, they always presented him through the 70s and early 80s as a guy, you know, the journalist, it's his fault, the critic, would present him as some guy out in nature. Again, the critics got it wrong.
Didn't talk the kind of language which Pete Townsend will talk for pages and pages and pages, a kind of sociological explanation, which is the stuff, which is how rock journalism is written. And rock journalists think that someone is articulate and rational if they talk their own language. And he talked a poetic language designed to disrupt their way of explaining things, which actually required more attention and more thought on their part to understand it. But of course, they never did that.
I know, and I agree. So I just want to, since I've never had the opportunity to spell this out, I just want to finish it another minute maybe.
Okay, thanks, far away.
I have this time, just to finish the point I'm making. But it soon overturned the beef art image, or the public looked for a new image. The reason it's only for 15 minutes is because the technological mix will create a new sensibility, which will need a new figure to match and reverberate that figure preference in the new audience, which is the shape of the new sensibility of the new mixed corporate media mixture. So shortly after the early 70s, as the baby boomer generation biologically aged and got into new environments in their careers and lifestyles, remember cable TV and FM radio and all these complex expansions of the TV environment were coming in, a new sensibility was created. Therefore, the image of beef art as a natural man would not appeal anymore. Thus, you could track through the whole history of popular culture and see how each image became resonant at a certain time and then fell away. This we could look at as a tetrad. And so David Bowie comes in as that retrieved high-tech kind of outer space metaphor as opposed to beef art guy. But he'll only last a little while. That's Bowie. And then another image. And then you had a retrieval by the youngest population of the baby boomer generation, those born in the late 50s and early 60s, who didn't go through the 40s, 50s of the first TV generation. They replayed the 60s hippie thing with punk rock. But punk rock had the totally opposite aesthetic. It was, quote, "We're a violent generation and we're proud of it," unquote. Whereas the semi-literate kids of the 40s and 50s, when they reached that identity crisis at the age of 20 or so in the 60s, still retained the homogeneity radio effect of trying to keep everybody together. So they tried to think we're all one, the hippies, and the whole love thing. That was like the last gasp of tribalism. The next generation, the punk kids, were more used to solitudinous, discarnate individualism, and therefore they satirized the tribal ethos with Nazi paraphernalia. Now, as I wanted to read all this, Ben, because it's something I've wanted to say a lot throughout our sessions, because here I'm saying this 2 years before your book comes out, and people didn't get your message right away, but as they got to know your writings and get to know later what your point is, I am talking about that on a broader scale, and I find it interesting that, you know, 12 years later we end up talking to each other. But isn't it interesting what I was saying about Zappa back then? If you had read that, and I think you actually did read this, because Jerry gave you something I wrote back when you visited '93, and it might have been this, it probably was, and you wrote back that Bob was an autodidact. I don't know if you recall that. You recall that?
I don't at all. I don't recall reading you or responding to Jerry about you. I remember him talking about you, but I don't remember any of this. No.
Well, what does it help you understand what my view of Zappa is?
It does. It's a sketch of a generation moving, you know, and it's a sociology of appreciation of artists, which I always find quite hard to load in, because I tend to think about aesthetic correctness or incorrectness from my point of view. I find it hard to speak for other people or to
imagine. But that's what you just said 10 minutes ago, that I'm not as affected by the mass media sociological things that are going on, the trends, as you are. You get quite depressed. That's another thing. Because when I read this just the other day, looking at it, I said, there's a lot of stuff in here that I've been saying to Ben, and that in my mind, Ben was trying to say in his book. I say here that Frank's not a musician. You know, he's making fun of music. Music's dead. You kind of say that in your way. He is not being limited to being a musician. He is just using the medium of the day, the electric guitar and rock fads, to get in there and mix
absolutely
it up.
But any musician who is really great and you really understand, you begin to understand is not really music.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the same is true of Bach and Beethoven and Mahler, and unfortunately, that when you understand what they are trying to do, you realize the whole paraphernalia of a culture is actually something they're fighting tooth and nail. That since the fallout of religion and the replacement of religion by secular culture, artists have been at war with society precisely because of the way they're demarcated as art, and that it's only the reactionary art critics and reactionary artists who embrace the role as art, because artists have always aspired really to be politicians and to be leaders and soothsayers and all the rest of it, and they find the role of art thrust on them quite frustrating, and it's a mark of defeat that they're known as artists, and that's what spurs the great revolutionary ideas of the 20th century. The idea that this bifurcation between art and politics, which is the same as the bifurcation between your subjectivity, what you feel and what you have to do as a citizen, that this split, that there's something wrong with it. And it's addressing the fact that there's something wrong with this split, which is what the people who behave, who I admire, are. And whether they're artists or politicians is something that I judge afterwards, and that's more how they're treated. You know, is Leroy Jones an artist or a politician? You know, how can you tell? They're somebody who passionately argues a particular case and gets involved with the people who can put this case forward, and you find it's in this area where the people outside that argument, who don't understand what the argument is, they want to categorize it as one or the other, and that's precisely what it isn't. And so you get this puzzlement all the time from conventional society about what this thing is. And we're trying to create that for now. And in order to do that, Bob, we have to drop a lot of the roles that are thrust on it, which is why I can't be a jazz critic, or why you can't be a Frank Zappa biographer, that we refuse to accept these roles. And precisely what we're doing in these dialogues is... I want to save the tradition of Beethoven and Zappa from the conformism that threatens to overwhelm it. I want to save the real part of that tradition, which is betrayed by the false respect of putting them on pedestals and treating them as art, because they're not art, they're urgent messages about how we live our lives. That's what they are. They're something which art or politics or religion are separated ways of dealing with, but none of those are sufficient for what these things are really making you do or making you think.
Yes, you sent an email to me last week. We couldn't tape last week. And then you said, I want to, we'll start next week. And you said, I want to talk about now and everything.
Yeah.
That's the definition of what you mean by zapping these artists. They want to express about now and everything right now.
And that is the only interesting thing to put against all the clutter and detail that we have to use in order to communicate with each other. That unless you've got the now and everything argument in your head, then everything becomes kind of some specialist activity in which you begin to wonder, why are these people doing it? It's only now and everything which opens up to hopefully making anybody interested in what you're talking about. Of course, we need specific things, and I'm very interested in particular dates and particular cultures and particular haircuts and particular methods of collecting vaginal blood. My partner's left one of them on the table here. All these things are crucial, but they're only crucial in the light of understanding them. And that's where I feel great sympathy with where you kicked off, was where you were talking about the relationship between freedom and understanding, because that's one of the stances which Frank took. He's an Enlightenment argument, that he's saying that freedom is based, can only be extended through understanding, that your ability to actually see what's there is necessary for freedom. And this goes absolutely against current notions of what freedom is, which it all seems to be freedom to evade understanding what is actually there.
Exactly, and this is what the meaning of the vacuum cleaner is. If you come in with living energy, involved with now and everything, you suck everything in and dispose of it. It's all cultural claptrap. Mm. And so Zappa, that's the positive part of being an industrial vacuum cleaner. You suck all that is that's in the way and dispense with it or reshuffle it and create the power of a new energy, which could be a new dirt. It's so powerful.
But what is this... sort of sentimentality about Frank Zappa's own production that arrived late in his life, and which a lot of the hardcore Zappa fans adopt, which always makes me feel slightly ill, where they quote one line from Joe's Garage about music is the best, and they what do you think of I dislike the record so much I can't remember its title, the collection of guitar solos with dolphins on the cover.
Oh, yeah, I have that sitting right over there.
Have you tried listening to it?
Transfusion.
Yeah, have you tried listening to it?
Yeah, it was okay, but I didn't go back and listen to it again.
Yeah.
Because I liked Imaginary Diseases, that album. Yeah. That had better performances.
But the positivity about music, which always actually limits music, the classical music, the great music of the past that we like, never sounded to people like music. It sounded like somebody was doing something to them which had never been done to them before.
That's right. The now and everything was coming back at them and massaging them, stimulating them, frightening them, frightening them. It's the now and everything. So it's interesting that the whole metaphor, you suck in everything with a vacuum cleaner, and that's actually the effect. Zappa wants to create an effect so that everything that was cluttered around you is sucked away.
Mm.
So he actually is trying to be a vacuum cleaner. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and in his graphic novel about Zappa, Andreas Rausch made the fantastic point that the gas mask that the young Frank played with was a gas mask with the filter missing. And so they have the idea of a Hoover or something sucking, which is unfiltered, that the universe that he's breathing in is absolutely everything. It's not a matter of selecting the right cultural bits and pieces. And the flip that I'm interested in, where suddenly everything in Zappa's art seems to turn inside out, and you have a paranoid feel that you're part of it, or that it is the actual universe you're in, is, I think, because of this unselective use of external materials. Because if we don't make sure that our artistic materials are those bought in a shop and are proper paper and proper colours, and you know, you walk into an art shop and you buy all that stuff, which if you buy you will make an artwork, and then you go out and you'll make some kind of miserable kitsch that'll be a pale imitation of all the art that's happened before, that if you deny that and say, well, I don't take special materials, I take what's around me and rearrange it, you're bringing art back to what all communication is, which is a rearrangement of materials which already exist. You're pushing things around, and that's re-manipulation of things is communication. And I think the art with a lowercase a you're talking about is direct utterance. It's utterance of social import that needs to be said from one person to another using what materials we have around us. And that is the genuine art and the genuine culture that needs to be done. And what's amazing is how few people are actually doing it, because people are so hypnotized by the capital art, which is actually just a cipher for money, that really they're talking about being impressed by monetary investment and speculating about who, what styles are going to get monetary investment and so on. They completely lose the idea of any necessary social communication. And it's that necessary social communication which I think the revolutionary commentator on what's going on around us must concentrate on and find, even if it's under a stone somewhere.
Zappa said that he was at one point studying the effects of behavior. Anybody who gets into the small a vacuum cleaner position is amazed at how everybody else appears hypnotized. You even got that in your madness period. That is the ongoing question of the small a drive, is how come no one gets it? Gets what you just said. How come they don't see that about Frank or about the capital A art world? And capital A art is the capital that you're saying is always happening, is always appropriating, is always sucking you in.
But I don't think they simply don't see it. They actually organize themselves against it. There is a...
That's where I didn't finish the thought. So I was thinking that the puzzlement, like when I when Zappa in the interview, the Bob Marshall interviews, he's asked, who are the brain police? He said, I'm still working on that. The puzzlement about why people are still duped on mass levels or group levels is the ongoing questioning and question that all real small A artists is always dealing with. Oh. It's always trying to figure out why are people wearing the same clothes, why are they choosing those clothes, and why aren't they getting in debt because of it?
Oh.
The clothes they bought. So So that, and I see that dialectic is always what you're talking about in your essays and what you quote on your show about the artist is always confronting capital. He's confronting within the art world, capital A art, which is a symbol for capital, but it's really about why are people hypnotized and keep working and suffering and enslaving themselves.
Well, because the artist has chosen that all they can do is to produce something to look at or hear which might make the people who are hypnotized dehypnotize themselves. That's where they've put and the here I suppose I allow a little bit of specialism in that the artist, if they begin to get illusions that they are doing politics in the spectacular sense, I think make a lot of mistakes, because they get into the idea, well, if I make these compromises with actually what I'm expressing now, it'll give me the space or fame or money so that then I can later on do something good. You know, the Bono U2 problem. Whereas in fact, by the time you've pumped yourself up to that size using those methods, you've become the monster that you're attempting to make a criticism of, and you can't do it. You're stuck.
That's right. That's exactly the dilemma. And that's what I wanted to say, I like the pattern you lay out in one of the two excerpts of Zappa's Hoover, where you talk about, he goes with the Turtles right after that great album Hot Rats. Then he goes with 200 Motels, the movie soundtrack, after what? After Grandmazoo. And then he goes into something else. He keeps canceling his image. He keeps ruining his image.
Yeah.
That string you did.
Yeah, you haven't got the chronology quite right, because the Grandmazoo comes after 200 Motels. I mean, the shock of 200 Motels is just when Frank is discovering how to get heavier and heavier in terms of musical bombast and the heaviness of rock at that period. He suddenly starts arranging for female sopranos and orchestras, and that for a 14-year-old who's just buying into, you know, I remember a program on radio called Fresh Garbage, and when me and my cousin saw there was a program on radio called Fresh Garbage, we were just saying, yeah, we got to listen to that, because Fresh Garbage meant heavy electric guitars, you know, just at the time when he's king of the heavy electric guitar, he suddenly writes music for shrieking sopranos, and it's the very opposite of the music you want to hear, and that giving you the opposite of what you want to hear is maintained in an incredibly high-pitched way throughout Frank's music. And this is why I end up apologizing for the worst records ever made, Frank's records, because I realized they were the opposite of what I wanted to listen to, and precisely there I can actually learn and open my mind. Although I find him a very special case, I get a little bit cheesed off with people so involved in invert aesthetics that they've always got to listen to something that's rubbish, and you know, that kind of inversion isn't quite what he's doing, because there's always a huge amount of research and sensitivity about the way he's organizing whichever genre he decides to annoy you with, that it's not cynical in the way that it is with some people of always having trash, you know.
And that dialectic is within each album. You like certain kinds of music, and then he goes on something you don't like, and then he goes back to what you like. You know, he actually plays. He even said once that he says the idea is to create a lot of I don't know if the word was dissonance, chaos, and then reunite it or create consonants, something like that. He's always playing that basic primitive beat in the body. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You like and you don't like. You like and you don't like.
Yeah.
You follow what I'm saying? That within the albums, he's upsetting you, annoying you, and then releasing you, and his larger output has that same dialectic.
Yeah, because finally you realize the being teased with intelligence is a far more enjoyable thing than being fed something which someone knows you're going to consume. And that being teased with intelligence is what we're all looking for, I think.
That's right. McLuhan said conversation is the best art, the most dramatic, and a good conversation or any interaction with another human being where you don't know where it's going to turn out is the essence of living.
Because then, and because then we don't know what's going to happen next.
That's right. And then if somebody brings in, let's say two people having a good conversation, some third person comes in and says, oh, well, you guys are talking about hippies or something. They categorize it. They can't get into it. And it's very hard to get three people having a conversation lively. And then four, that's where it becomes a crowd. So there's the crowd dynamic, which is hypnosis, because they can't take the interaction of too many one-on-ones happening, which you don't know where it's going to go, and then it has to flip and become a mass mind environment of hypnosis. I just figured out the core of evil. Sorry.
Yeah, but I'm prepared to stake out the territory with a few flags and a few solid objects that indicate the way and where a few people could collect together and talk. And that's what I think our function should be, is that we're setting out a few, driving a few stakes in the ground, saying a few people could gather around this object and dangling something from it. And if we talk about this object, we all might get somewhere, because this object is worth looking into. And that's what choosing artworks might be.
Yeah, and one of the constant motifs in your critical work is you cite cases where you go to a party and you don't like where the crowd's going, and you'll do something to annoy people. Often it used to be playing Zappa. That is the ongoing dynamic. Ben Watson's walking around looking for a conversation. He's happy if he gets a good conversation, doesn't judge how it happened, but it's happening. And then he hates it when the crowd starts to disrupt the conversation and bring a blanket in. You know what I mean?
And having it described like that makes me blush and is even more disruptive. Bob, what a great way to end the show. Thanks very much for talking to me. Talk to you next week.
Great.
Bye.
Thing.